We will start the House Special Committee on Energy. It is March 3rd, and it is 10:32. Can we have roll call?
Yes.
Representative Wool?
Here.
Representative Tilton?
Here.
Representative Klayman?
Here.
And for the record, Representative Vasquez, chairing the committee meeting, is present. Co-chair Representative Colvert is on his way. And we will proceed with a sectional summary on HB 78. Representative Tammy Wilson will make that presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent North Pole District 3. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to present our bill again, and with that is a sectional as well. But I do want to bring to attention, you know, a little sign as far as being closed for business. That's really what this bill is all about. We want to no longer be closed for business in the state of Alaska. We want to open it for business, for private industry to be able to come forward utilizing their funds and bring us more affordable energy. I'm sure you've had time at this point to look at HB 306 that got passed in 2010. That was our state energy plan, and in it, Madam Chair, it says that encourage economic development by promoting the development of renewable and alternative energy resources, including geothermal, wind, solar, hydroelectric, hydrokinetic, hydro, and biomass energy for the use by all Alaskans. And again, that's another portion of that. We heard last time at the last meeting that these were all private funds, not public funds. In the last 3 years, the state of Alaska has put in more than $212 million into electrical generation here in Alaska. Those are public funds, not private funds. So, Madam Chair, with your permission, I would like to just really simply explain what this bill does. I know it's a big bill, it's very confusing, and that's because of a lot of different kinds of changes that has to do with the RCA. But what does this bill really do for Alaskans? So when you get your, go ahead.
Representative Wilson, for the record, Representative Tallarico has joined the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And so let's go about your, everybody gets an electric bill, and you look at it every month and, you know, probably takes the wind out of you as you see how high it is. But let's just look at a kilowatt per hour. And the first part of it is that you'll see on your bill is what is called the base. And we're, you know, going to use that. If our kilowatt hour is 20 cents a kilowatt hour, and our base is 10 cents. The base is your buildings, the people, everything it takes to generate that electricity, whether or not anybody uses any of that. And that is regulated by the RCA. So we're not going to talk about that portion of it. We're going to talk about the other 10 cents that makes that up. And that's what you're hearing about the avoided cost, the cost for generation. What does it take to be able to make that electricity and also transmit it up the lines? For instance, Fairbanks uses some of the generation from gas from Anchorage. So on that 10 cents, what we'd like to know in the bill is exactly what does it take to make up that portion? Because what you do right now is we get an average. So for instance, and I'll use Fairbanks closely because that's where I'm from, and they generate it from coal, we have diesel, we also get gas, we use wind and others, so we'll have a different amount, what it takes to produce that kilowatt per hour from all those different areas. And just so if you think I'm going to look at the right, I've got Mr. Hayes over here who shakes his head to make sure that I'm good. So thank you. So that's what we're talking about. That's the area that our independent power producers look at to see whether or not the project they want to bring forward is competitive or not. Nobody wants to put money into a project that no one's going to want to buy that source at the end of the day. So now we know the bill would then make utilities break that down so you can see what the high portion of the energy is and the low that makes up that 10 cents. So let's use an independent power producer and they're going to build a project. And in that project, to generate that 1 kilowatt hour, it's going to be 4 cents a kilowatt hour, much lower than that 10 cents that we just talked about. Therefore, they're competitive. Well, not so fast, because now they have to get it on the lines and know how much it's going to cost to go per line, depending upon whose line that they're crossing. Kind of like when you go on a toll road. Most of you, before you go on a road, you're going to find out how much money it's going to cost so that you have enough on you. Another part that this bill will do is it will set those rates. So everybody knows what the rates are, and it's equal for everybody else. So let's say that that's 2 cents. Now I'm at 6 cents versus the 10 cents that I'm already paying. Representative Quest.
May the record reflect Representative Covert has joined the hearing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now I'm at 6 cents. I can save 4 cents a kilowatt hour if I were to build my plant, whatever that plant happens to be. Now it's time that I can go to the bank. I can say, do I need to borrow it? I can go look for investors. I can start conversations with that utility. That's really what this bill does. If it would have been the reverse and our numbers would have been higher, it would have been an uneconomical project and the project wouldn't be done. Because one of the things that we've heard, Madam Chair, is this is going to cost us more. We're not asking you to buy energy that costs more than what's already out there. What we're wanting at this point, especially during our economic issues that we're having here in the state, we want private investment dollars. We want private companies to come in and invest in Alaskans so that we can have more affordable energy. And they've already done that, Madam Chair, that we've got a lot of projects out there, a lot of money invested, and this is private monies that are competing, as I said, with the $213 million of state funding for other projects. So we don't even keep these projects even. We're competing with private business using state funds as well in a marketplace where the rules, nobody knows what they are because they're not all the same. And that's primarily what this bill does. And I hope it helps, you know, everybody kind of get on the same frame. So, Madam Chair, would you like to go through the sectional?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Does anybody have any questions at this point? Seeing no questions right now, you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not going to read it to you because I know you all know how to read. But I'm going to, you know, pull out the important parts of each one of the sections. Is there something in there that someone sees? We also have kind of a friend online in case they can speak to any of your concerns if you have technical questions. So Section 3 calls upon the RCA to apply these competitiveness and non-discrimination principles with respect to all energy producers, including qualifying facilities, independent power producers, and public utilities. In Section 4, it authorizes and requires the RCA to ensure that its regulatory decisions are consistent with the state energy policy, an energy policy that they went throughout the state to be able to put all of our needs in it. Subsection F requires the RCA to ensure the transmission assets within the state are open and accessible to qualifying facilities, independent power producers, and public utilities on a fair and non-discriminatory basis.
Madam Chair, let's hold it right there on the
yes,
subsection. Thank you. So if we had other legislation that created transmission cooperatives and had a unified rate for accessing transmission infrastructure, I guess the question would be to the bill sponsor, would this be necessary? So if we had a framework for a tariff to transport electricity produced by any and all entities on the grid, we wouldn't need that section. Is that true?
Let's go over to the chair. Absolutely correct. There are parts of, as the RCA goes further and other issues are brought that can be taken out of this bill. But it doesn't. But that particular one doesn't take care of all the issues that's brought forward. But that would absolutely be in the right direction.
Representative Tammy, I'm going to call a brief at ease, please. Record, it is 10:47. Representative Wilson, will you proceed with the section analysis? And copies have been provided both to the committee members and to members of the audience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I'm Representative Tammy Wilson from District 3, and we were on Section 5. Mm-hmm. Strengthens the language so that the RCA has both the authority and the duty to adopt regulation in order to carry out its responsibilities. Section 6, it streamlines rulemaking proceedings. Section 7, the annual report requirement provides transparency for market costs and provides the ability and encourages competitive independent power production to meet and beat establish generation costs to reduce the cost of power for Alaskans. And Madam Chair, I really want to point out that on Section 7, because that's been one of the concerns that we have heard, is that somehow we are going to make things cost more. And again, here it says, to meet and beat established generation costs to reduce the cost of power for Alaskans. Section 8 helps improve compliance with U.S. laws relating to qualifying facilities and competitive power to lower electrical costs for end users. Section 9 differentiates end users from wholesale, industrial, or bulk buyers of electricity. Section 10 expands RCA authority such that upon a disagreement between a public utility and another requesting party on terms and reasonable compensation, that the RCA may require a public utility to comply to terms and reasonable compensation for temporary use. Section 11 helps eliminate barriers for qualifying facilities and independent power producers in obtaining access to transmission facilities. Subsection D requires public utilities, other transmission service providers, to proceed with interconnections in a timely manner. Subsection E talks about who shall bear the cost of an interconnection study. Subsection F requires a public utility to provide open access. Okay, and that's another important part I'd like to show the committee. We're talking about open access for all to transmission assets on a fair and non-discriminatory basis. Nobody here is looking for something for free. Subsection G confirms the ability of utilities and other transmission service providers to impose interconnection and integration charges. Subsection H requires any system benefits resulting from an interconnection to be credited to the party seeking connection and used to offset any fees charged by the public utility or other transmission service provider. Subsection I provides that when requested by the RCA or a party seeking connection, the public utility or other transmission service provider must disclose the basis for its proposed interconnection and integration charges and must demonstrate that such charges are fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory, and otherwise in compliance with this chapter. Section 12, RCA to take action to ensure qualifying facilities and independent power producers shall obtain access to transmission facilities. As you can see, Madam Chair, we're talking about access and fair a lot in this bill. Section 13, ensure that fees charged by transmission asset owners for interconnection constitute reasonable compensation, reasonable integration charges. Section 14, limits the types of costs that public utilities can pass on to tax ratepayers. Section 15 authorizes and requires the RCA to review new or revised tariffs for consistency with the state energy policy. And again, it brings us back to all the work that our members did on the energy plan that we now have in statute. Section 16 is not exempt, and to add that any agreement under this paragraph is not exempt from the open access and anti-discriminatory sections. Section 17, RCA to allow utilities to pass on to taxpayers certain validated costs. Section 18, expands RCA oversight and investigatory authority. Section 20, eliminates conditions relating to power being generated entirely from renewable resources and the plant or facility not having been funded with state grants or tax credits. Section 22 exempts from regulation under this chapter all qualifying facilities smaller than 80 megawatts. Section 23 defines public utilities as well. Section 24 is a list of definitions that have been utilized.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Culver.
Section 22, Representative Wilson. Please explain that. Exempts from regulation under this chapter all qualifying facilities smaller than 80 megawatts. So there's going to be a lot of independent power producers under 80 megawatts. What is the scope and breadth of that section, and how would that apply versus if you applied it to or a facility over 80 megawatts?
And Madam Chair, through the Chair, Representative Culver, if I could, I have someone online that's taking these questions down, and I think she would be more, she would be able to answer the question better, if that would be okay.
Representative Wilson, for the record, who is that?
And that would be Teresa, should we have last name?
Clemmer?
Clemmer, yes. and she's writing these, those down, so in her testimony, that would be okay with Representative Colbert. Not necessarily now. Go ahead. What do you want to add there?
Ms. Clemmer, we will take your testimony in the order, not right now. We'll have Representative Wilson finish, wrap up.
Thank you very much. And that's the end of the sectional as written. And if there's one more thing that I could add, Madam Chair, with your indulgence. Again, it's just a little bit more clarification of what happened at the last meeting as far as one of the letters that we received from Alaska Power Association concerning that the bill would increase utility costs and consumer rates. I hope that by now you've all had time to look at the recommendations, the letters of support that we received from all throughout the state with those. What this is really about is using private dollars to bring us lower costs. One of the reasons that we're not able to grow in Alaska the way that we want is because energy. I mean, that's the biggest thing that we talk about on a constant basis is energy. And again, that's why I have this sign up here, closed for business. It's not just about having a monopoly that we all have at this point, and we needed that at one time. So don't get me wrong, when we were a small state, we couldn't expect investment to happen in a timely fashion without giving some kinds of guarantees. But we've grown since then. And we need to, as a state, we need to stop competing with private industry. We need to open up the lines. We need to give them that access so that, Madam Chair, we will be open for business and no longer competing with private funds. So with that, Madam Chair, I appreciate the time you've given us. I know there are many who would like to testify, and we will be writing your questions down so that we can speak to them later. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So any questions of the committee members? If you can hold your questions. Are you available, Representative Wilson?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I will be
thank
here.
You. So we'll take questions later. The next witness will be Teresa Clemmer. And she will be appearing telephonically. Ms. Clemmer?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, clearly.
Okay, thank you very much. And good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is, for the record, is Teresa Clemmer. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Visenya and Van Tine in Anchorage, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I have been working with independent power producers in developing HB 78, and I have also been involved in the rulemaking that's now under consideration by the Regulatory Commission. I'm here to provide a brief overview of what the bill does and how it relates and doesn't relate to that rulemaking process. I want to describe briefly five main goals in HB 78. So I'll list them briefly here and then talk about them in a little more depth.
Madam Chair.
The first goal is
excuse
to provide
me, Clemmer.
Non-discriminatory
excuse me, Ms. Clemmer. Yes. Excuse me. Representative Culver?
Yeah, thank you. Representative Wilson indicated you would answer my question on the 80-megawatt exemption from regulation, Section 22 of the bill. Can you address that and then do your prepared statement?
Representative and Co-Chair Culver, let's allow Ms. Clemmer to proceed with her testimony, and you may ask the question after she finishes her testimony. Thank you. You may proceed, Ms. Clemmer.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so the first goal of HB 78 is to provide, to ensure that fair, non-discriminatory access is available for Alaska's transmission infrastructure. The second goal is to strengthen the Regulatory Commission's oversight authorities relating to utilities. The third goal is to reduce regulatory burdens on small, independent power producers. And the fourth goal is to implement Alaska's energy policy. And the fifth goal is to provide guidance to the Regulatory Commission relating to its oversight of power purchase agreements between utilities and small renewable energy producers. And I wanted to really point out that this fifth goal is the main area where this bill most directly relates to the regulatory process at the Regulatory Commission. The first four goals relate more strongly to transmission. So I'm making a distinction between transmission and these power purchase agreements between individual utilities and independent power producers. So starting with the first goal of fair, non-discriminatory access to transmission infrastructure, I'm sure you're aware that the vast majority of transmission facilities in Alaska were state-funded or subsidized in one way or another, and future upgrades will undoubtedly be state-subsidized as well. So these are public infrastructure facilities similar to highways that everyone should have access to in order to support a competitive marketplace. The problem is that small independent energy producers must often negotiate multiple transmission agreements with a series of utilities along a transmission route. And this leads to excessive and duplicative wheeling fees and other types of charges that can stand in the way of beneficial projects.
Excuse me, Ms. Klemmer.
Yeah.
Ms. Klemmer, before you proceed, can you explain to everyone what is a wheeling fee?
A wheeling fee, that's similar to what Representative Wilson was just saying with kind of like a toll on a highway when you just have to pay to be able to use the highway. A wheeling fee is the charge that a utility imposes on someone who wants to use its transmission line to get their power from one place to another. And in Alaska, because our system is fairly fragmented, you end up having lots of utilities imposing toll upon toll upon toll. So that they call this pancaking, where they just stack up all these charges rather than streamlining that and ensuring that those charges are not duplicating each other and are not adding up to be a really unreasonably high level. Does that answer your question?
Any questions of the committee members? Okay, you may proceed. You just mentioned that that phrase, and I wanted to make sure everybody was understanding what you meant.
Okay. So this is the problem, is that you can have the stacking up of these charges because of the multiple layers of utilities along transmission lines. HB 78 is designed to ensure that transmission facilities are accessible on a fair, non-discriminatory basis to everyone, including utilities and independent power producers, in order to support competition in the power industry. And you can see this most clearly in Section 4 of the bill, subsection F, and also in Section 11 of the bill, subsection F. And also, as Representative Wilson emphasized, when we say fair and non-discriminatory access, we do not mean utilities will be burdened with extra costs. There are several provisions that make that clear. HB 78 specifically provides that transmission owners are entitled to, and I quote, reasonable compensation, end quote, for allowing the shared use of these transmission facilities. It defines that term, reasonable compensation, to include both the cost of maintenance and also, and I quote, a return on the private equity of the owning public utility or joint action agency. So any expenses that might be incurred by a utility in allowing someone to access its transmission lines, just like accessing a highway, those expenses are going to be borne by the person or entity that is asking for the access. And you can see that most clearly in Section 13, subsection C of the bill, and also in Section 24, Definition 20, defining reasonable compensation. There's another provision also that confirms that the parties seeking access to transmission and not the utilities will bear the cost of modifications or additions necessary to accommodate the joint use of the transmission facilities, and that's in Section 10, subsection A. Another provision, and this relates to one of your questions, HB 78 anticipates the integration of the transmission system that is currently under consideration by providing for joint action agencies to be treated in the same manner as other regulated utilities. So that term, joint action agencies, has in the past been exempt from much of regulation in this chapter. And one of the things that this legislation does, it says that joint action agencies, which may be a group of utilities or other entities that are come together and own and operate transmission facilities, are going to be regulated in the same fashion as individual utilities. And you can see that in numerous places in the bill, in Section 2A, 20L, 23, Definition 6, 24, Definition 18, and Sections 25 and 26.
And also,
as you just heard in the sectional, HB 78 will require utilities to proceed with interconnection in a timely manner, and that's in Section 11B. The second goal of HB 78 is to strengthen the Regulatory Commission's oversight authority. And we know that everyone would prefer to have a negotiated and mutually satisfactory agreement for transmission access, but as history has shown, that's not always been possible. So HB 78 authorizes the Regulatory Commission to step in and break the logjam when utilities and small power generators cannot reach an agreement on the terms for access to transmission. There's a provision for the RCA to take a short-term action and establish what the terms will be for a period of 90 days. And you can see that in Section 10A and 13D. And then there's also some provision for a long-term Regulatory Commission action where if they proceed with an investigation and a public hearing, they can specify what the terms for transmission access are going to be on a longer-term basis. And you can see that in Section 12A and 13E. And there are a few other provisions relating to RCA oversight that I will skip over for now, but feel free to ask questions. The third goal is reducing regulatory burdens on small independent power producers, and this goes to Representative Kohler's question. There are two different things that the bill is doing here. The first one is that the exemption, and let me clarify, the exemption means that these small producers do not have to get a certificate of public convenience and necessity. They're not subject to rate regulation. They're not subject to having tariffs. These are all the things that the Regulatory Commission manages with respect to utilities because of their role in serving the public. But when you're talking about wholesale power, those regulatory requirements are just not applicable and not really appropriate to impose on wholesale providers. So there are two categories of exemptions here. The first one is for all qualifying facilities, which are defined in federal law to mean renewable energy producers under 80 megawatts. And so those are exempt under Section 22U. And that is a requirement of federal law, and it's really not something that the state of Alaska can tinker with. There is another aspect of this bill that exempts certain other independent power producers that for one reason or another do not qualify as qualifying facilities under federal law, but that meet specific criteria specified in the bill. And you can see those criteria in Section 21R. All right, moving on to the fourth goal of the bill, implementing Alaska's state energy policy. As you've heard, the energy policy establishes statewide policy goals of developing more renewable energy, encouraging economic growth, and encouraging private investment in Alaska's power industry. HB 78 gives the Regulatory Commission the tools to ensure that Alaska makes steady progress toward achieving these goals. It requires, for instance, the Regulatory Commission's regulations to be consistent with the energy policy, and you can see that in Section 4E and Section 5A. And the other major thing that it does is it requires utilities' tariffs to be consistent with the state energy policy, and you can see that in Section 15D. And so finally, I'm moving on to the fifth major theme of the legislation, and that is providing guidance to the Regulatory Commission relating to oversight of power purchase agreements between utilities and IPPs. And I just want to also clarify that we are at the very beginning of that process. On February 25th, the Commission just voted to open up a public comment period on a draft rule, but there has not yet even been a public notice issued kicking off the public comment period. So we have several months before we're likely to see a final rule. And this window of time is a perfect time for policy guidance from the legislature to encourage the RCA to move forward appropriately during its decision-making process this coming spring and summer. There are a couple of provisions in HB 78 that will provide that guidance for the development of the draft rule. The one you've heard about is the avoided cost, and as Representative Wilson was emphasizing, avoided cost is a term that is used throughout the country. It's very well understood in the energy industry. It operates as a ceiling to ensure that power purchase agreements are cost neutral to utilities and ratepayers at the worst. That's the worst that can be, is cost neutral. In practice, there's usually a substantial cost savings for utilities and ratepayers under these power purchase agreements. So we're looking at either cost neutral or cost savings, which either way should be good for Alaska. HB 78 makes it clear that the Regulatory Commission has the authority to approve a power purchase agreement at or below a utility's avoided cost. And you can see that in Section 16C3. And additionally, to improve clarity, HB 78 defines the term avoided cost to mean incremental avoided cost, which is essentially just bringing Alaska in line with the way it's done in the whole rest of the country. We're the only ones that have a different definition of the term. Incremental avoided cost is the standard term, and that's in Section 24, Definition 15. And the second main thing that HB 778 does relating to the rulemaking is that it ensures that fair and non-discriminatory charges are the only things that can be imposed by a utility in a power purchase agreement. And that relates to the physical facilities that are involved in connecting an independent power producer to a utility system, and also the operational adjustments that are involved when a utility tries to integrate that new power into its system. So we're just looking for fairness and non-discrimination, and we're not trying to impose any additional cost on utilities or ratepayers. So I'm happy to end it here and to answer any questions you may have.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Cummers. Representative Colfer, do you have any questions?
Yeah, on that same subsection, in Section 22 on the exemption, you referenced that the 80 megawatt and under exemption for IPPs was for renewable energy only. Doesn't apply to an IPP, coal, gas, cogeneration, any of those other things.
Well, there's actually two things going on here, and in the sectional analysis, I'm looking at it. Section 20 and 21 are actually kind of merged together, so it's hard to see Section 21. But Section 22 relates to this provision 711U, and that's where we're talking. When you see the term qualifying facilities, that's referring to renewable energy, and that's a term defined in federal law. So 711U and Section 22 are the ones that are relating to renewable energy projects. Section 21 is the one that does something a little different, and it creates an exemption for other small independent power producers that, for whatever reason, don't qualify as a qualifying facility. And there are some particular criteria that have to be met for those other IPPs to be exempt from the certification and rate regulation and tariff requirements.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Through the Chair, I don't see a sectional analysis for 21. Am I just missing that? I go from 20 to 22.
Right. If you look at the bottom of the page where Section 20 is, and then the third line down, there's some bolded text. Right. That should have been a separate paragraph.
Okay. All right, there we go. So, can you just recap on the non-renewable and as it applies to this proposed law, where it would apply, where it wouldn't apply, regulated or not regulated?
Yes, through the Chair, I'd be happy to. The criteria, and I'm going to go actually to 711R in the bill, which is a little easier to follow than the sectional analysis on this point. So the first criteria for getting this exemption for something for an IPP that's other than a qualifying facility is that it is built and put into operation in a certain time frame between 2010 and 2025. The existing version of the bill had the time frame ending in 2016, so we're extending that to 2025. It has to be smaller than 80 megawatts. Existing law says the cap on this exemption would be for 65 megawatts, so we're just proposing to increase that slightly to 80 megawatts. And then the next criteria would be that the IPP sells all of its power either to a regulated public utility, which is already true in existing law, and the idea there is that the protection of the regulatory framework is being carried out through the regulation of the utility that's receiving the power, so there's no need to also regulate the wholesale provider in the same way that you would regulate the utility. And then there's an alternative here where you have the purchaser being outside the utility's certificated area that does not constitute the public as defined in existing law. And the idea of that is there's no need for regulatory protection for the public if the power is being sold to something like a mine or a manufacturing facility or just an independent large buyer that's situated outside a public utility's service area. So those protections, those regulatory protections kick in when you're talking about selling power directly to the general public. And then finally, there's an exemption for a plant or utility that sells more than half of its power to purchasers outside of Alaska.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Representative Wolf?
Well, sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And this has come up several times, but with the topic of transcos and ISOs and all these kinds of entities, most everyone that's presented to this committee, whether they be a utility or an IPP or supporters of this bill, all talk about pancaking and tariffs, and it seems pretty unanimous that everyone would want a system that is dispatched by an independent entity, and that there's a single rate to move electricity around, and that there isn't pancaking. So it seems to me everyone's pretty unified on this. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that that's generally true. I guess I would just also add, through the chair, that this bill, if it's passed, would not necessarily prevent there from being multiple utilities, that we would not do the job of establishing a transco. It would just say that whether you're talking about multiple utilities or a transco, either way, access has to be provided on a fair and non-discriminatory basis, and the charges have to be not excessive, and they have to be reasonable. So we're just imposing some sideboards on what those charges can be. And so this kind of a provision really, I think, lays the groundwork for a transco. It's just broadly applying this non-discrimination requirement to all utilities, whether they're operating individually or in a joint fashion. And that is a perfect segue into the creation of a transco. And another point is that we don't know for sure whether a transco will be created this session or whether that might take longer. But in the meantime, this kind of a provision will provide some protection to these small entities that are trying to get access to the transmission grid.
Thank you. One more follow-up.
Sure.
Thank you. Cost neutral, you mentioned that the we'd have to provide cost neutral power purchase agreements. This would be cost neutral for everyone involved?
Yes. Yes, for a power purchase agreement, that's what the avoided cost term means, is that it's the same as a utility would otherwise pay. So they're either going to buy it from one place or from this IPP, and the cost, at the very worst, the cost is going to be the same. But in practice, because these independent power producers are really seeking long-term contracts and some security, and they want to avoid the uncertainty of selling power on a day-to-day basis, they're almost always willing to negotiate for a price that is much lower than what the utility's avoided cost would actually be.
And that would include interconnection and intergeneration and the other mentioned costs as well, correct?
Right. Avoided cost is the sum total of all of those considerations, the price for the power and the fees that are charged for interconnection and integration and the system benefits. It all goes into a formula and at the end of the day, it has to satisfy that cap of not being greater than avoided cost.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Teresa. I had one follow-up question. You made reference to the rulemaking process that's going on with the RCA, just recently started, and we've got this House Bill 78 in front of us. Do you see a difference between the rulemaking and HB 78, and can the RCA basically, in their rulemaking, adopt everything that's in HB 78? Or is HB 78 do more than the RCA has authority to do, in your opinion?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, yes, this bill does more, and it has a broader scope than the rulemaking. As I was mentioning, it's really in the realm of these power purchase agreements between individual utilities and independent power producers, where there's some overlap. But this bill does many other things. The requirements of non-discriminatory access to transmission really addresses a problem that does not arise in these individual power purchase agreements in the same way that it does when you're talking about an independent power producer being stymied by having to deal with a whole series of utilities. So that's really one of the major ways that this bill is different than what the RCA is doing in its rulemaking.
Follow up. So in your perspective, the RCA rulemaking wouldn't be able to address effectively what we call the pancaking effect of somebody in Homer trying to send electricity up to Fairbanks, for example.
Right. What the rulemaking is doing right now is just establishing some specifics for the power purchase agreements between the utility and the wholesale provider that's selling the power to the utility. So this is a purchase contract for the power. It's not primarily a transmission-oriented negotiation.
Maybe more than one follow-up. If there's a lot of interest in trying to get to where we have a single transmission entity that essentially takes out that pancaking challenge, does this bill get us there? If we pass this bill, would we still have more work to do as a legislature to try to come up with a way to deal with what may be accurately perceived as a need for a single transmission entity?
Thank you. Through the chair, this bill, I think, is an important first step. It helps address the situation by creating this non-discrimination requirement and this requirement for reasonableness in terms of the fees that can be charged. And reasonableness of the costs that the IPPs are agreeing to pay. They're not trying to get out of paying anything. They just want the cost that they're being charged to be fair and not excessive. So that is really the first step, I think, towards rationalizing our transmission system. But in order to create a new entity like a Transco, you would need separate legislation to do that.
So I think this is my, so what the IPPs are, they're happy to pay, by analogy, they're happy to pay a set postage stamp that I would pay the same stamp rate, but they don't want to buy a stack of pancakes.
That's a good analogy. I think, although this particular bill does not specify whether they have to pay a series of charges or a single charge, it just says that the calculations that determine the charges that they have to pay have to be fair and non-discriminatory.
Thank you.
Ms. Clemmer, this is Co-Chair Representative Vasquez. How does this bill address avoided costs, and how is it different from how it's treated now?
Okay, so the key thing that this bill does with respect to avoided cost is it inserts one word into the definition of avoided cost, and that word is incremental. And it's really a small change in terms of text, but it can make a really big difference in terms of the way that utilities and independent power producers negotiate with each other. Utilities generally have a portfolio of different power sources that they draw from when they're providing power to customers. And right now, we have a regulatory process that says that when a wholesale producer comes in and they want to compete with the utility and say, I can meet or beat your cost, you know, I can do better than your avoided cost, what they're having to compete with is the average cost of everything in the utility's portfolio, even if it was built 50 years ago, even if it was built with a lot of state subsidies, and even if it's not the first thing that would be turned off when the new power comes in. And that's really the key thing. That's what incremental means, is that what the new power coming along is displacing and what they're competing with is the first power that would be turned off, which is generally the most expensive power in the portfolio. So if you have a facility or a utility like Golden Valley, in their peak periods during the winter, burning really expensive diesel because it's their last resort power, and you have an IPP that can come along and say, I can give you power for half that, then this creates an obligation for the utility to buy the power that's coming in at half the highest cost rate, rather than forcing that competitive entity to come in and say, I'm going to have to compete against an average rate that really doesn't bear any relationship to what I'm actually displacing. That answer your question?
Yes. Are there any questions? Can you give us another example?
another example of for avoided cost?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you could have, for instance, the Fire Island Wind Facility. My understanding is wanted to come in and sell the Phase 2 power to any of the utilities on the Rail Belt grid that would buy it. And they ran into trouble with the pricing of it. In that case, they weren't competing with diesel, like is the really most expensive power in the Fairbanks area, but in other parts of the Rail Belt, gas power is becoming more and more expensive because the contracts are all being renegotiated and gas power is becoming more expensive. So if wind power can come in at a cheaper rate than gas, and particularly the gas that is the last resort power that's produced in the highest peak periods, then those are the rates that should be the basis of what the is paid to the independent power producer when they come in. It doesn't mean that there can't be negotiation, and often you get well below the cost of the most expensive power, but that really helps the negotiations move along because you don't have the utility saying, we're going to nickel and dime you and we're going to pay you less than we're saving by buying your power. Does that help?
Representative Wohl has a question.
Yeah, just for further clarification, and you can use the Golden Valley example again, and since that's something I'm a little bit familiar with. But I know they don't want to burn diesel at their super high price of doing that. And so if someone comes along with wind power and they say, well, you can buy our wind, obviously they don't want to pay the same price as the diesel because then there's no savings. Also, if they buy the wind power, they're going to have some spinning reserve for when the wind dies down. Obviously, they're using diesel because it's a high-demand moment. If it's a high-demand moment, they can't rely on an unreliable source. So there's spinning reserve that has to be maintained. I'm assuming that all figures into this avoided incremental cost, correct?
Yes. I think the Golden Valley example is the poster child for why we need to remove some of these obstacles to these projects. That diesel power, we're talking about costs of 30 cents, 60 cents, sometimes even a dollar per kilowatt hour. And we're talking about wind power at 14 or 12 cents a kilowatt hour. I believe 12.5 has been thrown out there. And so we're talking about a dramatic difference in cost between the fuel that it would cost to run the diesel plants and the wind power that's coming in.
I understand that, but if I have wind and they're using diesel, does a wind producer want the utility to pay the diesel price?
No. My clients, I've been working with AEP on this for a long time, and we've been involved in negotiations with Golden Valley, and they've been offering a flat rate of about 12 cents for a long time, and Golden Valley has been comparing that to its average rate, which incorporates all its cheapest sources of power, and has not been comparing that to the actual displacement of this really expensive power. So we're talking about independent power producers that are really asking for something very reasonable and something that would save consumers money in many, many instances, but the utilities have just been very reluctant to agree to.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions, committee?
Through the chair, I just wanted to follow up also on the spinning reserve aspect of that question. The spinning reserve, in many instances, is a very modest cost, and it gets blown out of proportion into being something that sounds like a very expensive cost, but utilities provide spinning reserve for their own other power sources all the time, and they provide spinning reserve for each other. They provide spinning reserve for economy sales that are basically energy sales between utilities from one utility to another. There's a lot of spinning reserve already built into the system, so the additional spinning reserve that might be needed to accommodate a wind facility or another renewable facility is really a very small amount in comparison to the money that can be saved.
Thank you.
Ms. Klemmer, I have a question. How does this bill affect integration and fees for integration?
Well, what we were just talking about, spinning reserve, that's the primary component of integration costs. When a utility says there are some operational adjustments and costs that need to be taken into account when they accept wind power or another type of renewable energy power. Mostly what they're talking about is the spinning reserve or this backup power that needs to be available in case the wind dies down. But as I said, there's spinning reserve is also more broadly used to back up all other kinds of power in case of an outage or a malfunction at a facility. There's the spinning reserve already going. And that's basically more or less the same as the integration terminology.
So how does this bill, HB 78, affect integration costs?
All it does is define the term. It confirms that IPPs, you know, independent power producers, are responsible for paying integration costs to the extent they are attributable to their facility. And it just defines that term to ensure that it's applied in a reasonable and even-handed fashion. So if you look at the end of the bill on page 13, the definition 21, it defines them with a series of standards. It says reasonable integration charges or credits means the fair, non-discriminatory costs there are, and then there's a list of things that are criteria for what an integration charge is allowed to include. They have to be directly attributable to the system connection, reasonably necessary to maintain safe and reliable operations of the utility system, in excess of the corresponding costs that the public utilities would have otherwise incurred, not duplicative of the costs already charged related to the system connection, and offset by benefits attributable to the system connection. So all these things are just basically fairness type standards to ensure that the utilities aren't allocating too much to these integration charges that really should be attributed to something else on their system.
Any questions? For the record, I see no questions. I do have one final question, and that is, are you using interchangeably integration and interconnection, or are you going to make a distinction for the
record? No, if that's a good question. Those are distinct terms. Integration refers to this idea of needing backup power or spinning reserve. Interconnection is a more straightforward term. It basically refers to any new transmission lines that need to be built, any new transformers that might need to be installed. It really refers more to the hardware of getting an independent power producer hooked up to a utility system. And those are much easier to track and account for. There's usually, you know, invoices and receipts, and those are much more tangible. So we don't usually see so many arguments about interconnection costs. It's the charges for these integration costs where there tend to be more confusion and disagreement.
How does this bill affect, if any, interconnection?
I'm not sure if this bill, let me just double check. In the regulations, there is a definition of interconnection. I'm not sure if that's included in the bill. There's nothing new in the bill relating to interconnection.
Any other questions? No questions?
No questions.
For the record, I see no further questions. Thank you, Ms. Clemens. And
thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next witness will be David Gillespie. Mr. Gillespie, if you can.
Thank you. No at ease required.
Thank you.
Okay.
For the record, please state your name and affiliation.
Thank you. My name is David Gillespie, and I'm the chief executive of Alaska Rail Belt Cooperative Transmission and Electric Company, ARCTEC for short. This needs to be short. I want to thank the committee, co-chairs Vasquez and Culver, for giving me the opportunity to speak today. Forgive me for reading from prepared remarks, but you'll thank me in the long run, as I won't wander off into the weeds. Before I start on my prepared remarks, I'd like to make two comments on the avoided cost discussion that we've been having today. One is, I think everyone should be aware that avoided cost, incremental or otherwise, varies minute to minute, day to day, and year to year, and that a utility's avoided cost on the coldest winter day is different than it is on the warmest spring evening. And so when we talk about the unit of last resort, that very well could set the avoided cost for a couple hundred hours a year, but there's also several thousand hours a year where it could be a hydro plant that is the avoided cost. And so I think as we talk about incremental avoided cost, we need to be recognizing that that's what that means. The other thing that it means is that avoided cost in the context of an independent power producer typically means over the next 20 years, because that's often the term of an independent power producer's contract, and so the utilities are required to make an estimate of what that avoided cost will be out into the future, and about the only thing you can say about that estimate is that it will be wrong, and that therefore utility customers take on a significant amount of new risk in signing contracts, even at what is perceived to be today's avoided cost. There, I needed to get that off my chest. As I said before, my name is Dave Gillespie, and I am the Chief Executive Officer of ARCTEC. We're an organization formed by four whaleboat utilities to address industry issues that are of our mutual concern. Our members are Golden Valley, MEA, Chugach, and the City of Seward. And each of our utility members exists only to provide low-cost, sustainable, and reliable electric service to its customers and its residents. Personally, I've worked in the energy industry since 1982. I've been involved firsthand in the implementation of restructured energy markets in New England and in California. I worked for 10 years in the independent power business, and I've worked in the renewables business. Before you today to speak in opposition to HB 78, the Alaska Competitive Energy Act of 2015, not because ARCTEC doesn't support the basic principles of open access and competition. We do. We believe that independent producers can manage risk and innovate in ways our existing utilities may not. In all of our interests, it is to create a regulatory environment that is transparent and fair both to new private investors and our existing customers. However, our view is that HB 78, though well-intended, is not the appropriate vehicle to achieve our mutual goals of low-cost, reliable, and sustainable energy and the economic development opportunities that it affords. So my comments are going to address four primary topics. First, the detailed implementation outlined in the bill is best left to the RCA. It's an undeniable fact that the workings of the electric system are complicated, and it's unlikely that a single prescriptive piece of legislation can optimally address the myriad circumstances that the RCA deals with every day. We believe that legislation should focus on what we're trying to accomplish and leave the how we get there to regulators. In fact, as it's been mentioned a couple of times, the RCA is working on just those details in its docket R1302 and in its newly opened informational docket 1501. My second point is that the bill contains a number of ambiguities and potential unintended consequences, which are likely to actually reduce clarity for stakeholders, not increase it. For example, the bill at Section 9 proposes changes to statute to replace the word customer with a new term, end user, which is then defined to exclude industrial use and bulk buyers of electricity. Is it the legislature's intent to create a new distinction between industrial customers and other classes of user? Is it clear what a bulk buyer is, or is that in the eye of the beholder? Section 14 of the bill proposes statute changes with that in most cases disallow utilities from recovering the costs in, you know, quote here, adjudicatory proceedings or judicial actions against a qualifying facility or independent power producer, end quote. Is it the intent of the legislature to prohibit utilities from ever having a dispute with a QF or an IPP, regardless of the circumstances? These are just two examples. How will these ambiguities be sorted out? How will customers benefit if each of these points must be hashed out through the courts instead of through an orderly regulatory process? Rather than creating a stable regulatory framework, we believe the bill could actually have the opposite effect. Third, most of the provisions are already covered by federal law or in the RCA's recently proposed rules in 1302, which is, you know, the IPP docket. So at best, much of the bill is redundant. At worst, it's in conflict with existing statutes or regulations. Some of the bill's proponents have stated that part of HB 78's intent is to harmonize state law with the federal PURPA law. This makes no legislative sense. PURPA is indeed federal law, and it applies in Alaska just as it does in the rest of the United States. If our objective is to be more like PURPA, we don't need a new law. We need to live by the existing one. Furthermore, the RCA is in the final stages of issuing guidance on many of these very issues. What would be the outcome if those regulations are ultimately found to conflict with the provisions of this bill? We believe it's most appropriate to defer to the RCA's process, which has thoughtfully reviewed reams of evidence and hours of testimony on this topic. Finally, HB 78 doesn't get to the real fundamental problem in the rail belt, and that's a lack of robust infrastructure and a regulatory framework that will allow energy to economically flow to where it is most needed, when it is most needed. The legislature should focus its efforts on enabling law that sends a clear direction to the RCA, to implement a stakeholder-governed, independent, or unified system operator model that is based on a set of broadly accepted guiding principles. A new regulatory paradigm governed by a USO will provide the level playing field and the regulatory stability needed to create real opportunity for independent power producers. It will allow the state to attract capital for needed infrastructure. It will enable additional economic activity, and most importantly, implementing a USO in the rail belt will help us to better provide low-cost, reliable, and sustainable energy to our residents, our members, and our taxpayers. Thank you again for the opportunity to address you today, and I'll take questions if you have any.
Co-chair, Representative Culver.
Mr. Gillespie, so you represent RTEC, which is rail belt utilities and focused on transmission and independent system operator for the connected grid and the rail belt.
I do.
Okay, I'm just wondering what dog you have in the fight with independent power producers, especially those that would be off-grid or in closed grids, and avoided cost issue and those kind of things. I guess just convince me why your entity would have an interest, because you stand for a free and open competition on the distribution network, but this is specifically designed to allow access to the market, right?
Representative Culver, can you please shorten your question? It's quite long and quite confusing, and even though our witness may understand totally what you're talking about, we have other members of the audience and in the community.
Well, Madam Chair, I disagree. I would like my question answered. Thank you.
Let me paraphrase it. I think I may have gotten it. Is the question, how does this pertain to things not the rail belt?
Yeah.
Our focus is the rail belt. And so when we look at this law, the people that I represent are the rail belt. They represent the majority of the population of the state. And so I am speaking to the rail belt specifically.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Gillespie, Representative Klingman has a question.
You took the time to prepare your remarks. Could you also submit the written remarks to us?
I did.
That was exactly what I was going
to
ask him.
They're
out there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Are they on a letterhead or just in
actual letterhead?
I got them here.
Mr. Gillespie, we'll take the next witness because they're appearing, they're calling in from Minnesota, but can you stay in the audience in case we have time to go back to you, and after the members read your written comments, they may have additional questions.
Okay.
We don't have the written comments in front of us at this point.
Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. Appreciate it. We'll call a brief at ease.
It is, for the record, 1144. Mr. Jim Bertrand, are you on the line?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair. Jim Bertrand here.
Thank you for calling in. Can you please state your name for the record and your affiliation, and you may proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. My name is James Bertrand. I'm partner at the law firm of Stinson Leonard Street. I work out of our Minneapolis office. I'm testifying on behalf of Chugach Electric Association. My remarks are going to focus on the letter that I submitted to Madam Chair, Co-Chair, yesterday, and I understand that it's available for the committee.
Yes, it is. Let's pull it out so we have it in front of us. And you may proceed, Mr. Bertrand.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I presented this letter based on my recollection of the questions that were asked at last Thursday's meeting of Ms. Elephant, the lawyer calling in on behalf of the Alaska Independent Power Producer Association. So if it pleases the committee, I will go ahead and just address each of the questions briefly, summarizing the answers that I've laid out in writing.
Yes, you may proceed. Thank you.
The first question that I believe was asked by Co-Chair Culver was how Alaska is different from other states when considering PURPA. The main point that I'd like to make is that the public nature of the utilities, particularly those on the rail belt, and I am limiting my comments to the rail belt utilities, are that these are public power and utilities, either electric cooperatives or municipal utilities. In other states that have similar utility systems in that they are dominated by the public power, these states always also have a very low percentage of independent power producer generation, both in the form of the total of overall generation capacity and in the form of megawatt hours produced. I prepared attachment A, which is a ranking of the lowest 40 states using both of those criteria, using the 2012 energy information reports by state. And the summary presented on attachment A, based on my calculation, shows that Alaska is 45th out of 50 in states like Tennessee, Nebraska, Missouri, Kentucky, and South Carolina are 46 through 50. The significance of these different rankings is, you know, you ask the question, why are these states also having very low independent power producer capacity percentages? And it is because they also have significant public power percentages of their public utilities. In the state of Tennessee, the Tennessee Valley Authority dominates the electric markets there. In Nebraska, the entire state is served by public power districts. Missouri, Kentucky, and South Carolina all have very significant amounts of electric cooperatives. Similarly, when you look at the lower level, which is a percentage of megawatt hours, those statistics show a very similar approach, but in that case, Alaska, based on the Energy Information Agency reports, is 44th out of 50. The other thing that I wanted to mention in response to how Alaska is different is what has already been discussed in the hearing today, and that is the there is a move toward evaluating based on the legislator's directive in Chapter 18 SLA 14 Section 31B to determine whether creating an independent system operator or similar structure for electric utilities in the rail belt area is the best option for effective and efficient electric transmission. Last Friday, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska issued an order opening a docket on that very point, and I've attached that as attachment B, and it you can see the various questions that the commission is seeking input on from the Rail Belt Utilities, the Alaska Attorney General, the Alaska Power Association, the Alaska Energy Authority, independent power producers, and other interested persons. I recall that Ms. Elfond indicated that this type of system in the lower 48 is one where there is a high percentage of independent power producer involvement, because it does create a level playing field. And so this docket is likely to result in movement toward that type of single transmission system operator, and is one that is supported by Chugach. If I may continue, then the next question was how PURPA applies in Alaska. I believe that was from Representative Klayman. And my answer through the chair is that PURPA, as noted earlier in the hearing, already applies in Alaska. There have been some efforts by the commission to harmonize some of the regulations to reflect some updates over the in the time period from when the original Alaska regulations were adopted. But significantly, as identified by the commission staff, these changes would require the same level in transparency in reporting our obligations as FERC for about 20 Alaska utilities, and on the issue of avoided costs. They would address interconnection costs and integration fees in a reasonable, non-discriminatory way, and update the definition of avoided costs to include incremental costs as FERC does. Notably, as a backdrop for this, is that federal law would preempt any statute or policy that would go beyond the application of PURPA, and that's very clear federal law based on constitutional preemption. The third question was the question about lawsuits. Again, I believe that was from Representative Klayman. And I wanted to point out that lawsuits are available under PURPA, so there's no additional need to create opportunities for that. And the way it works is that you could go to FERC with complaints, or you could go to the State Commission for complaints. But I offered a recent FERC order involving an Alaska independent power producer that brought a petition to FERC, and FERC ordered that they are now free to pursue any action in court that they wish to do so. I've attached that as attachment D. I forgot to mention that I've attached the proposed regulations for PURPA as attachment C, so you can see the changes, many of which look very similar to what are found in HB 78. Finally, I believe Co-Chair Vasquez asked about the transparency for avoided costs, interconnection fees, and integration costs. And as I mentioned, the attachment of the proposed regulations that the commission from the commission staff addresses those very items. Thank you for the opportunity to present these answers, and I stand ready to answer any other questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Klayman.
Thank you. This is a little bit off. Well, I'm looking at attachment A that you prepared, having to do with these other states with a small amount of independent power producers, and I'm just curious, from a consumer perspective, when I see Tennessee is having the lowest percentage of 3.2%, how does their electric cost reflect the consumers? if you know.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Klayman. My understanding, also based on the energy information reports, is that in Tennessee, the rates tend to be fairly low, and it is for the same reason that they're low in a relative sense in other parts of the country, and including even in Alaska, where the utility rates for those customers that are served by rail belt utilities tend to be lower than those not served by the rail belt utilities. And the significance of that is that part of it is a question of what's the infrastructure to serve the community. And secondly, it's the public power cost advantages in the form of low cost of borrowing and the availability of other government-related costs, which, by the way, are not passed through to ratepayers except to the extent that they require recovery from a borrowing perspective. So public power in general is cheaper than investor-owned power, and that's why in many instances the independent power producers have a better chance in those communities served by investor-owned utilities than they do with public power utilities.
Thank you.
Representative Wu.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A previous speaker here from ARCTEC, if I may paraphrase, and hopefully I'm correct, sort of summarized that RCA is working on a lot of these issues that are in this bill, and that if a lot of these questions will be addressed by them, and we should possibly just wait, and also that the legislature, if it's going to act, should act to try to create a USO, a unified transmission company.
System
operator. Thank you. Get these little jumbled in my head. Would you agree with that? With that, those two statements,
Madam Chair, Representative Wall. I would agree with the first statement. I think the second statement is one that's a little bit difficult to answer because it may or may not be that the legislature needs to do more. That's part of why this new docket from the commission is so important, because everyone can weigh in on their views on whether or not there's a current legislative framework that would allow them to move forward. In some states, this type of independent system operator has occurred through cooperation among utilities, and so there is a possibility that you would not need special legislation, as long as the commission felt it had the regulatory authority over the ultimate entity, and all of the utilities agreed, then you could envision a unified system operator that did not require further statutory enactment. But I think that's really going to come out of that process.
So all the utilities would have to agree, not 4 out of 5 or 5 out of 6 or 4 out of 6 or something like that, right?
And through the chair, Representative Walt, that would be the typical scenario, unless there was some ability to do it for a utility that was not, you know, was maybe on the end of the system, so you could get all the benefits for the rest of the system. It's conceivable, at least.
Okay, thank you.
And for the record, the RCA, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, opened this docket just on Friday, last Friday, February 27th. We will have someone from the RCA provide testimony on Thursday. It is now close to 12. Thank you, Mr. Bertrand. I think there are no questions at this point. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for testifying. And we do have additional individuals that wish to testify, but we're out of time. We will continue the testimony on Thursday, March 5th at 10:15. So everyone is still encouraged to come and testify telephonically or in person. Are there any other matters I should take up? The committee is adjourned.